All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome. Nice to see everyone, and happy Valentine's Day. So we saw, hopefully you saw the screen share with the image. And you know, we start these meditations, we'll read those verses. But I thought today, since it is Valentine's Day, we could start off with a little bit of metta, loving kindness. All right, so I'll just offer a few words to get us started. Taking a few breaths as if we're moving just through the heart center. The center of the chest is where the breath is flowing in and out. Waking up this area we call the heart. And connecting with the intention of well-wishing, of kindness. Kindness toward yourself, kindness toward all beings. So if you would like, starting with a few minutes of metta, offering it to yourself, offering it to your dear ones. May you be safe and protected. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. Repeating these phrases or whatever phrases you like, or simply the silent, wordless quality of metta. Offering it to oneself and to those who are dear to you. May you be safe and protected. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. And continuing with metta for a while, switching back to insight practice or metta the whole time, whatever you would like. May all beings be safe and protected. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings live with ease. All right, welcome back. So I think we'll have this rhythm of reflecting on each of these images, each of these verses throughout the month, and helping it kind of sink into our subconscious and then see what arises from that. So I'm going to just go back to screen sharing and reading the verse with you for a moment. So searching for the bull, searching for the ox. In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull. Following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. So just taking a moment to take in this image. So this first picture and this first verse, you know, it's a little bit, it really kind of takes us right into our struggle, right into our sense of confusion, our doubt, our uncertainty about, you know, which direction to go, what are we looking for? And so from a big perspective, big picture perspective, this is showing us not only the beginning of our spiritual path, or spiritual practice, but also times that we cycle through periodically in our practice. There's times when we lose sight of what, why we're practicing. We lose sight of that clarity of practice. We lose sight of what really brings happiness, what brings suffering. Those kind of all get muddled together. And, you know, before we practice, you know, we often don't know where true happiness lies. You know, what is really what causes happiness, what allows happiness to start to take root in our hearts. And then conversely, we don't really understand what creates suffering, what creates that difficulty of our lives. And so this picture, you know, as I talked about last week, really points to that, that quality of why, you know, that searching for happiness and not sure where to find it. You know, kind of this cluelessness. Recalling the image, you know, so this person's in this steep hillside, you know, feet are going one way and they're looking over their shoulder and trying to see, you know, which way is this bull? Which way is the ox? And the bull we can have, or the ox can have, different representations. It's often meant to be our true nature, you know, what we are, our essence. And right away we're kind of at an odds, because if it's our true essence, why are we searching outside for it? Why are we searching through the mountains for it? So that's one of the jokes on these 10 ox herding pictures. As we search and search outside for something, that ultimately we find is inside of us. That's later on in this series of pictures, we start to struggle with that sense of who I am, my true nature, and try to get it tamed, and eventually do tame it. And then at some point, we realize there's no separation. But at this point, we don't understand this. At this picture, we don't know that's really within us. And so we're looking around everywhere for it. So let's go through some of the lines and kind of highlight some of the pieces there. So the first one, in the pasture of the world. And I don't know what that brings up for you, but that for me, that pasture of the world is the kind of the landscape of my life, the landscape of my activities, my friendships, my acquaintances, my family, my loved ones, the ones I have to struggle with, all these different arenas that I live and walk my life in, my work, my avocations, my hobbies, everything is along this kind of spectrum. And not only, you know, the relationships, but also just the whole trajectory of my life. And, you know, the fact that I was born some number of years ago, and it's some number of years in the future, I will pass away. And, you know, that those two points from birth to death is this landscape of life. And how do we live this? So in this pasture of this world, you know, we're endlessly searching, pushing aside. I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull. Endlessly pushing aside the tall grasses. So tall grasses, you know, you can't quite see above them. They're right blocking your view, and you're trying to look and see where is happiness? Where is this thing that I am searching for? As I read this last week, I'm going to read it again, this quote from Ajahn Chah that so much speaks to this sense of moving and searching for happiness. Or in this case, the relief of our suffering. So Thai forest master Ajahn Chah said, "The Buddha once saw a jackal, a wild dog, run out of the forest where he was staying. It stood still for a while, then it ran into the underbrush, then out again. Then it ran into a tree hollow, and then out again. Then it went into a cave, only to run out yet again. 1 minute it stood, the next it ran, and then it lay down, then it jumped up. So you get this sense of this restless nature, this always searching, always trying to escape our suffering. So the jackal had the mange. It stood, the mange would eat into its skin, so it would run. Running, it was still uncomfortable, so it would stop. Standing, it was still uncomfortable, so it would lie down. Then it would jump up again. Running to the underbrush, the tree hollow, never staying still. The Buddha said, "Do you see that jackal this afternoon? Standing, it suffered. Running, it suffered. Sitting, it suffered. Lying down, it suffered. It blames standing for its discomfort. It blames sitting. It blamed running and lying down. It blamed the tree, the underbrush, and the cave. In fact, the problem was with none of these things. The problem was with his mange. And our mange is not understanding right view." Right? So this picture and this little quote from Ajahn Chah to me really come together in this searching for something, searching for happiness, or searching for the escape from our suffering. And because we're essentially confused, we're lost in these woods, we're lost in the hills, the endless paths, the many rivers. We don't know what causes that suffering. We don't really have a clear sense of that. And yet we go all over the place looking for it. We don't know where our happiness lies. So we search everywhere. Where? We blame this, we blame that. We think this will give us happiness. We think that will. So it's this picture, it's kind of intense to stay here for a month, but it's like staying in the first noble truth that there is dukkha. It's like, let's really feel that. Let's really sense it. Let's really open to it. Because so often we want to alleviate it. We want to jump to, how can I get free of this? How can I escape from it? And I think sometimes we do that prematurely before we really truly connect with our dukkha, really connect with the nature of our suffering, to really understand it. We want to jump to the solution. And it's mirrored in, you know, our interpersonal relationships, that often we're listening to someone who's hurting in our lives, and we quickly jump to try to solve the problem instead of just listening a little more deeply, a little more fully to their experience. Dropping the need to do anything with other than simply witness, simply take it in. So this picture comes to mind that same quality of literally taking in this restlessness, this lack of success in finding lasting happiness, this lack of success in finding ease in our lives. To let that really sink in. And then the clarity, when it starts to come, is really highlighted, is really informed by knowing the dukkha in its depths. So what really brings this happiness? So again, in this picture, the next phrase, next verses or lines are, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. So you just, if you've been in an area that has all these paths which are seemingly chaotic, not going, you don't know where they're going, there's this bewilderment that happens. There's a sense of being lost. And this is really the story of the Buddha's life, the story of any really sincere Dharma practitioner's lives, is that we come to realize that, you know, the way we've been doing things don't work. They're not really doing it for us. We keep trying, but yet they always end in sadness or in loss. We find the next thing, and we don't even notice that grief, that loss there. This is reminds me of that little verse from the suttas of the Buddha, when he was reflecting that before he became the Buddha, he was noticing that he was too was seeking for happiness. He was trying to find, where is this lasting happiness? He was a bit shaken by seeing the heavenly messengers of illness, of old age, and of death, because he thought his happiness was really fairly lasting. It was so permeating his whole existence. Everybody he saw was healthy, was beautiful, was young. And to see people who were sick, people who were aged and who were dying, it was just really shook him, because he realized he couldn't rely on his circumstances. He couldn't rely on his youth and his health to last forever. He reflected that the things he was looking for happiness were impermanent. They're in a quality of always rising and passing away. And he realized that he himself was impermanent, not only his body, but also just the very sense of him, the sense of mind, or I, of me, of mine, was also impermanent, was also in flux. And he realized that was not a good way to go about finding happiness, something that was impermanent, trying to find happiness in something else that was impermanent. Right? So this is this looking through, endlessly searching, following the unnamed rivers lost in the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, those paths that we take to try to find happiness, to try to escape from our suffering. So then, of course, there's a point where our practice, we become a little, sometimes it's just a disillusionment with our normal way of finding happiness, of seeking happiness, that we just, well, how many possessions do I have to have? How many relationships, how many positions do I have to have before I finally feel like I've arrived? There's always something a little bit more, something else that's needed. And so that disillusionment sometimes turns the shape of being just exhausted. Just your strength is just spent because you're searching endlessly this way and that way. So the next line, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. I cannot find the bull. Right? So this is this kind of wise sense of failure, this failure that actually allows us to grow in a way that we wouldn't have if we didn't have that failure. I mean, thinking back to your life, I certainly can look at my life, and some of my greatest growth has come after failing, after falling down and just feeling like I just can't do this. Something else emerged, either a different direction or a different depth of willingness or courage or fortitude came forth, or I had to let go of something very fundamental myself. This is mirrored in some of the, like the hero's journey, that often we go into these very difficult things where everything's stripped away and we're asked to release something very fundamental in order to grow and to actually continue on that journey. But this is also mirrored in so much of the Zen tales of awakening, that time and time again, someone tries and tries and uses all their effort, and at some point that effort fails them. But yet if they didn't use that effort in the first place, there wouldn't be the impulse or the energy to really release. So that's kind of a preview for as we come on to these other pictures. But right now we're right in the midst of that struggle. And I think especially as Westerners, we tend to be a little struggle adverse. It's fine if you struggle a little bit, but you come on top, you win, you're the number one team. But to actually be in that struggle, there can be so much growth, so much learning. This is where this series starts, this picture starts, is this place of exhaustion. That in the pasture of the world, I endlessly pushed aside the tall grasses in search of the bull. Following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. The bull that's actually your true nature, something that is not something to seek outside of yourself, but actually realize just it's inside of you to uncover what's already here. And the last line is, I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. So as I read it today, that only stood out, you know, that discounting, oh, it's just those crickets. They're just that sound in the background. What I'm looking for, I can't find anywhere. There's only those crickets chirping through the forest at night. But yet if we hear those words, they're calling us into a different relationship to the present moment, into nature, into that the crickets are the quiet voice of that ox, of that true nature. And yet so easy to discount that, to ignore it, to not see it. And so these pictures often do show us that energy, that sense of striving and working so hard, and also showing us the release of that, the dead end nature of that, and how that quiet call of the locust chirping, that's the beginning of sensing where the ox is and sensing where it might be in your own heart and also in the practice. So this first picture, it's a little intense when you see this is the way I'm sort of exploring it, saying, notice our struggle. Notice how we're always seeking happiness in ways that aren't fulfilling. Notice how we're trying to escape from our suffering in a way that doesn't fully alleviate it. You know, does this relate to the Four Noble Truths? I think so. Really understanding the noble truth of dukkha, of suffering. Really letting that sink in before we move on to the understanding the cause and the cessation. Let it sink in before we go into seeing the ox and learning to work with the ox, to tame the ox. So in the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted. I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a moment or two, and then I'll frame our discussion. All right. So in a moment, we'll do some small groups, and it's a great time to discuss and share, feel that sense of Sangha, to really have a chance to articulate your understanding or your confusion or your struggle on the path, and to support others in that, to hear their own voices, to hear their own experience. And this is some of the things that really make the Sangha come together and really help people feel connected within the community. And these are optional, so if you prefer to sit this out, you're welcome to, or you could jump off the call and come back at 8:30 for this large group question and answers. That's perfectly fine too. So the homework from last week was to reflect on all the ways you seek happiness and peace which do not ultimately succeed in permanent happiness. So noticing, you know, reflecting on all the ways, you know, it could be like the different careers you've tried, the different jobs or houses or possessions, is how do I keep trying to find happiness? You can bring your practice, you know, things that I try to do concentration, then I try to do metta, then I tried Utejaniya, then I tried Mahasi, and you could just try all these different things and just kind of bring forth your failures, basically. And same thing with how you try to explore or try to escape your suffering. You know, how many ways do you try to avoid pain and suffering in a way that doesn't ultimately work? You know, a mind state comes up and you try to distract yourself, try to ignore it, and it comes up again and again. Okay, so this is, you know, it's not going to be, hopefully you have some humor as you explore it to keep it light, but it's really about noticing the struggle that is represented in this first picture. All right, welcome back, everyone. So we have a chance now to see how that discussion went. But Kathy, looks like you're unmuted, so maybe you can mute yourself. Okay, so how to find the ox herding pictures on the website. I put that in the chat earlier, but I'll put it back. Okay, so there is a link to the page that Cheryl Marlin and Tuareg Salah developed. So it's a lovely site, lots of information there, and has all the pictures and the verses. All right, so I'm curious what you talked about. What's your exploration around struggle, the fruitless struggle, the confusion of your life and of your practice, and what came up from that discussion? Yeah, Alan.
Yeah, I wasn't really excited about talking about struggle, and I didn't know how it was going to be with the group. But yeah, it was really nice. Everybody just kind of opened up and shared, you know, just some very, very real, very real descriptions of the struggle. And yeah, it's interesting, like when you go deep into that struggle in an authentic way, you know, you can kind of hear the chirping of crickets sometimes. So yeah, it was very nice.
Nice. Yeah, good. So yeah, that chirping of the crickets, because we're in the middle of that struggle, and it seems like there's no way out, and yet there's something that comes from, you know, beyond. Like we have to exhaust all our other possibilities, and I think sometimes as humans we're kind of stubborn that way, like I'm going to keep trying even though it doesn't, you know, it doesn't ultimately work. I'm going to keep trying. So good. I'm glad that, you know, that even the trepidation about, you know, sharing the struggles, it was a good group. Anything else, Alan?
No, just that I appreciate the sharing with the folks I was speaking to.
Yeah, it's kind of unusual to be able to share that kind of stuff with other people, because usually we don't want to, you know, share our struggles or share the difficulties. And you know, again, the first noble truth is there is dukkha. This first picture, there is the being lost in the mountains, searching for something. All right, Sheila, go ahead.
Well, I think I was very nervous going into this group as well. And really, because, you know, the talk, Tuareg had been talking about it, be making ourselves so vulnerable, whatever else. So it took a little while to relax into it, but I really enjoyed my group too. And, you know, everybody was very candid. And I think the thing that struck me is the sense we get of commonality, you know, within the group where we are all struggling, you know, each person, some of us, we each brought up different things, but yet we all were saying, oh yeah, me too, you know, me too, you know. So there's a great sense of support in that, I think. So maybe I won't feel just quite as nervous next time. Maybe. Yeah. So good experience. Yeah.
Good. Yeah, I think that's a good lesson that both you and Alan have shared, is that sometimes the things we're most nervous about actually have the greater potential for growth or for connection. And it kind of brings us out of that sense of isolation, because, I mean, how many people, you know, feel like they're the only ones who struggle? I mean, have you ever had that thought that I'm the only, everyone else is doing so well, and I'm the only one who's really struggling?
Yes.
And, you know, for people to be honest and to share, it's like, wow. You know, we're all in this together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, that's the gift of Sangha, and the willingness to be vulnerable and to share honestly, and also the container of it has to be enough sense of safety, enough sense of that I can relax, I can relax as much as I can to do something that I'm nervous about or apprehensive about. And just as a kind of for everyone, this is something I learned from one of my one of the trainers or teachers that for my teacher training is that you can share something that's very personal and very tender and intimate in a kind of in a without giving a lot of details, if you will. Like let's say I want to talk about this a difficult breakup of a relationship or something. I can just say, there's just this difficult relationship issue, and I can focus more on my experience of it. And sometimes the content or the detail, that's what we often feel a little more shy about or guarded about, but how it's affecting of us, how it's really showing up for us, that we can share much more easily. Sometimes the details are really helpful to share and to put out there. And sometimes, you can also kind of keep it more vague. Like there's something that happened and I feel really a lot of sadness and guilt about. That gives, that gives people enough to know and enough basis for you to talk about it without having to feel like you're at the confessional and having to lay out all your dark secrets. So thank you, Sheila. Anyone else like to share anything? All right, Deb.
Hi, Tim. In our group, there were comments made about loss, what several members had lost things recently that were very meaningful to them, pertaining to health, perhaps, personal health, friendships, relationships, and the attempt to deal with this by trying to regain those things, even though I think there was a sense and understanding that those things were lost, really truly permanently lost in some cases, or perhaps lost for a long time, but just struggling with loss as an attempt to regain happiness and thinking that that would bring happiness. And then three of the four of us voted that recognize that chocolate really does bring happiness, and that is a truism recognized by the teachings, actually. And so that was also a little matter of discussion too on Valentine's Day.
Yes, thank you, Deb. Yeah, some people feel like these paintings are actually done in chocolate ink. But yeah. I don't know if that's true or not. But
oh, it's definitely true. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so it's that sense of that tenderness around loss, and the very human thing of trying to, try to alleviate that loss, to try to get back, what we care about. And there's also just that hard reality that things come and go. Things are born, things die, relationships end, people move away, people pass away. And how do we meet, where do we find some place of really peace and ease in the midst of that? It's not the same ease of sitting on the beach in the sun or something. It may be a very different quality of ease, but that's really the riddle that the Buddha has tried to undertake. And this is part of, part of this whole series is to look at that and to see, okay, where is that? And it's appreciate the tenderness and the honesty that you guys shared. And we're really kind of, I'm kind of holding you to your feet to the fire a little bit, like, okay, what's this, look at this confusion, this bewilderment. Usually we go into the different ways we can cope with it, and certainly chocolate can be a coping mechanism, which sometimes is really helpful. So next time, next month, perhaps. All right, thank you, Deb. So I see Judith.
Yeah, I was in the same group as Deb, and I was actually the dissenter on the chocolate issue because I don't like chocolate. And I was told that I was weird, but I know that already. But we did talk a fair amount about distractions, how we distract ourselves. And then I was curious to know if it's possible to live without distractions, or whether it's a question of balance, or whether it's a question of knowing that, okay, you know, you're going to eat your chocolate or you're going to read your Kindle in my case. And yeah, this is just like a break. I need a break, you know, from dealing with things. But I know that this isn't like what's going to bring me happiness. I know that because of, I have a long life of trying to find happiness in all the wrong places. And so, yeah, I'll ask you the same question. Is it possible to live without any distractions?
And when you say distractions, are you talking about like a way of kind of distracting yourself from the issue at hand or the difficulty?
Just distracting. Yes, it could be that, or even just distracting yourself for a while from just dealing with things and life. Yeah. And letting your mind just go somewhere else.
You know, it's an interesting question. I think it's, what I know is possible is to become more and more conscious around that process.
Right.
And that's a part that's, you know, I think many of us can see that or be much more, it's very attainable to, because usually our distractions before we start to train our minds or become more, you know, self-aware, we're just kind of driven by those distractions. We don't even realize we've already kind of, you know, gone a different direction. You know, we're surfing down this website instead of working on the article I need to write. It's like we just kind of go down that way. But the more mindful we are, we're able to actually see that impulse to distract. And then, you know, that start to become infused. Is it really a distraction or is it really actually very skillful to do that?
Right.
You know, that's start to have,
my question. Yeah.
So if you get a better sense of, you know, when am I really overworked, overwhelmed? You know, when do I really need to take, you know, something to take the pressure off? To, you know, to give a sense of ease. And, you know, what can I use to balance my mind? And so a distraction may not actually be a distraction. It may be much more of a wise choice. So I think the wisdom comes in more and more. It's a wise choice instead of I just can't deal with this anymore. You know, it's like you realize, okay, this is more than my system can handle right now. So actually it's coming from a place of compassion.
Right.
Yeah, that's what comes to mind. Because I think most people, you know, unless they're living a very rarefied life, you know, are going to have, at some point, the rubs are going to be too much. You know, people, you know, teachers I know who are, you know, very well-practiced, at some point, you know, they need to take a break. They need to, you know, maybe get away from the students or get, you know, replenish themselves. And that might look like a distraction. Mm-hmm. You know, those of you on the call who've experienced really deep personal loss of loved ones, you can't just stay in the midst of that grief, you know, nonstop. It's like it's actually very healthy to distract yourself, to do something that's unrelated to that. It gives you a sense of a breathing room. It allows your mind to relax. So, mm-hmm. So I think that kind of the unconscious, you know, reactive distractions fall away more and more, and you become more and more aware when it's a skillful thing.
Great. Thanks.
Hey, you're welcome.
Tim?
Yes. Go ahead, Susan.
First of all, we had a wonderful discussion in our group, too, similar to what others have said about kind of scratching, my words, scratching the surface and how easy it is to see the struggle in our lives. And, oh, I forgot. Yes, that too, and that too, and that too. And I'm resonating, though, with what you were offering about feeling the dukkha and not just jumping to the understanding part, because there is something that pain, you know, is communicating, is teaching us. And I really enjoyed that I really am looking at that terms of, you know, feeling that dukkha, whatever that struggle is, just to be in it rather than jumping to, you know, this opportunity this year to be focused on these pictures. And yeah. Usually it's so easy just to go to understanding. Oh, yes, that's, you know, that's dukkha. That sounds. So I'm just really, I'm just sitting with that and recognizing how easy it is to see that struggle and appreciating that experience to feel that rather than to have it just go over my head and not know what it is or to just, you know, distract myself in unhealthy ways from it.
Yes.
So yeah, thank absolutely. You.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's that sense of the struggle, the difficulty. Sometimes the more sophisticated we get as practitioners, we become really adept at just kind of letting go of things and coming back to like our breath, for example. So like a painful emotion happens and we just like, okay, I'm just going to release that. And yet in that releasing, we're not really learning. And so I think it's helpful to develop this capacity and also this willingness to, yes, sit in the midst of that dukkha a little bit more, to actually feel that impulse, or that feel that the suffering that has the impulse. And we can, you know, before we practice, we have the impulse to, you know, to unwisely distract ourselves or avoid or deny or try to fix. And we become more sophisticated as practitioners, we have the impulse to just, you know, apply skillful means and stop it. You know, and that's, you know, that, and we start to learn to meet life just how it is, including the difficulty, before we add our trained mind of letting go. You know, once we can do that, then it's helpful to be able to be in the midst of that, to be in relationship to that struggle. And that's, you know, I think that's, that works on this moment-to-moment basis. It works on the much deeper levels of our lives. You know, like, you know, people who are in recovery, you know, there's that, you know, that phrase of hitting the bottom. It's like sometimes people think they've hit the bottom, but they haven't really. And then they relapse or they start to use it again. And they just, it takes a while to really, really feel the depth of that dukkha, to unflinchingly look at it, to really say yes. You know, I'm helpless in the face of this. And that becomes, if it's really taken in and then there's right support, like there's so much so skillfully done in so many recovery groups, then that becomes the basis from really a deep recovery that sticks. And so it's similar, you know, in our lives. It's like, okay, really deep down, what, when push comes to shove, where do I think happiness lies? You know, where do I think this escape from that lies? And to start to notice that our first, second, third, fourth, maybe fifth answer isn't really doing it. You know, and so then what is left? What is left? And this is where these pictures take us. They take us to a very deep place of letting go. So it's not about staying in the suffering, staying in the dukkha. It's using the dukkha to really see it with open eyes. So there's an unflinchingness around it.
May I add the other part about the hitting bottom is when you stop digging, there's a piece too that's a koan, perhaps not to be answered, but. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you stop digging. Yeah, how often do we keep doing the same pattern, the same process? And you know, we're talking about patterns, like there's, and really, I think this is really looking at a much deeper, the deepest perspective, you know, around separation, around self and other. That's really the assumption that we dig down to actually, that's actually what we see. The superficial parts are just expressions of that in all their myriad ways. They show up. All right, I see Iris has her hand up. Go ahead.
Thank you. Sort of taking off from what Susan was talking about and you know, how you responded to her. For me, trying to discern what I do with feeling bad. And it feels like it's such a subtle moment. And I suspect that I'm needing a lot of those moments because they come up all the time. You know, they don't last for a long time, you know, but they come up and then they go away. And, you know, like, you know, dozens of times during the day, you know, because everything's always changing. And I think that I might meet those quick moments with some quick aversion, because I'm mindful of the feeling, and then it's also like when I look at something beautiful, like a sunset, and like not wanting to hold on to it, and so like I'm sort of asking you. I mean, I don't know that you can answer it because I think I have to discover this for myself as much as, you know, like, how do I just be with something without grasping or pushing away?
Yeah, that is a question, isn't it? How do you, you know, how to be with something without pushing and grasping and pushing it away, trying to hold it too close or trying to pull it away? And that's a question that is, you know, I think it's a really life question to hold that, to really be with that for a while. You know, that sense of, and you have both the positive side and the negative side, right? The things which are beautiful, the things which are lovely in your life that you want to, you know, hold on to. And there's the things that you struggle with. And there's that, the similar kind of holding away. It just looks like pushing away. And so a lot of it comes down to just noticing, where's that subtle story making, that subtle sense of, this is me, this is mine. And start to bring that to the forefront, because that's really where the grasping is. That's what it means to grasp, that what it means to cling, is that you're creating, the you is activated, is really activated around that thing. You know, and so that's the part to start to really explore, because when that you isn't being activated, then things just are arising and passing away without any friction. And that happens throughout the day, just those things we don't usually catch our eye. You know, you see something that's just mundane in your house and you just kind of glance over it, but it doesn't activate that sense of you, that wanting you, the we that wants, the you that doesn't want. And so it's like that's using that very grasping, that sense of grasping, because you know what that feels like. It's like, oh, I don't want this to leave. I don't want this to be here. Mm-hmm. Just try to reinterpret that or look in a different way to see, oh, I've created a sense of me around that. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, yikes. Because I create a sense of me about, you know, everything.
Yeah, it's the fundamental habit that we were trying to explore.
Yeah,
it's a very deep habit. It's, you know, and it's not just your habit, it's like everyone has that habit. So we're constantly bumping up against other people, and it's like we reinforce that constantly with each other.
Yeah,
and that's really, you know, the first line in the pasture of our world. That's the landscape of our world. And that's why the Buddha talked about this practice being going upstream, is to question that fundamental habit, that fundamental perspective. And yet that questioning that and seeing the emptiness in that, that's when this whole thing finally makes sense. That's the whole thing.
You can kind of see why somebody might want to go to a cave for many years.
Yeah. Sometimes the everything kind of bumping up against you becomes, it's hard to get that ground, and you know, yet the very bumping up, you know, shows you the opportunity. So just kind of play with it. You know, what I would suggest is just start to become curious with that sense of I, of me, of mine, you know, and hold all of the activity, the footprints, the momentum from that more lightly. right? So when something comes up that you, a beautiful sunset, it's like, oh, this is beautiful. I wish I had my camera, or I should have upgraded to that different phone. I mean, there's all the storyline. I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but we can, you know, we can have all that storyline arise around it. Usually that's where we reside. And that just is, just, that just reinforces that. But just notice, oh, there's a, where's that sense of me right now?
Mm.
And notice the impulses to think, to do, to speak that comes from that.
Okay.
And then just kind of hang out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point you start to see there's little gaps between that. That's not a constant, because we have this assumption it's a constant thing that's always here. But as you said, there's lots of stuff coming and going. Mm-hmm. And notice how those different senses of you arise. You know, sometimes it's a happy sense of you. Sometimes it's a sorrowful, sometimes angry, sometimes jealous, sometimes sweet, sometimes kind. You know, it's all these different qualities. And you start to say, wow, you start to see for yourself how impermanent that actually is.
Totally.
And you say, well, what's actually observing all this? If I'm always coming and going, there's something else that's here. What is that?
Thank you.
All right. Give me a full report next week.
Totally.
Yeah, this is, you know, basically we just described the whole ten ox herding pictures. You know, this is really where the pictures go. So I'm looking forward to exploring with all of you. All right. Anyone else like to share anything? All right. So next week we'll have another talk on this, and you'll see, we'll see what comes up from that exploration. I think we'll probably start to move a little bit more into that last line, hearing the critic or the locust chirping through the forest at night, to start to bring a little bit more of that hope, so you don't get exhausted staying in the dukkha. All right. Well, I look forward to seeing you next week and continue our exploration of this.